cigarette with a gold lighter. He stopped to talk with each of his girls. He touched a bare shoulder, a cheek, caressed someone's long blonde hair. The women all looked stunning. They wore their own beautiful clothes and had carefully applied makeup. The scents of their perfumes filled the room. If only they could rush him all at once, Naomi thought to herself. There had to be a way to take Casanova down. As some of you may have already guessed, he raised his voice, we have a nice surprise for tonight's festivities. A little night music. He pointed to Naomi and beckoned her to come forward. He was always careful when he brought them together like this. He had his gun in hand, holding it casually. Please play something for us, he said to Naomi. Anything that you'd like. Naomi plays the violin, and very beautifully, I might add. Don't be shy, dear. Naomi couldn't take her eyes off Casanova. His robe was open so that they could see his nakedness. Sometimes he had one of them play an instrument, or sing, or read poetry, or just talk about their lives before hell. Tonight it was Naomi's turn. Naomi knew that she had no choice. She was determined to be brave, to look confident. She picked up the violin, her precious instrument, and so many painful memories swept over her. Brave, confident, she repeated inside her head. She'd been doing that since she was a young girl. As a young black woman, she had learned the art of acting poised. She needed all the poise she could muster now. I'm going to try to play Bach's Sonata Number 1, she quietly announced. This is the Adagio, the first movement. It's very beautiful. I hope I can do it justice. Naomi shut her eyes as she brought the violin up to her shoulder. She opened her eyes again as she placed her chin on the rest and slowly began to tune the instrument. Brave, confident, she reminded herself. Then she began to play. It was far from perfect, but it did come from her heart. Naomi's style had always been personal. She concentrated more on making music than on her technique. She wanted to cry, but she held back the tears, held everything inside. Her feelings came out only in the music, the beautiful Bach sonata. Brava! Brava! Casanova shouted as she finished. The women clapped. That was permitted by Casanova. Naomi stared out at their beautiful faces. She could feel their shared pain. She wished that she could talk to them. But when he brought them together, it was only to show off his power, his absolute control over them. Casanova's hand moved and lightly touched Naomi's arm. It was hot, and she felt as if she'd been burned. "You'll stay with me tonight," he said in the softest voice. "That was so beautiful, Naomi. You are so beautiful. The most beautiful one here. Do you know that, sweetheart? Of course you do. Brave, strong, confident," Naomi told herself. She was a cross. She wouldn't let him see her fear. She would find a way to beat him. Chapter 59 Kate and I were working at her apartment in Chapel Hill. We'd been talking about the disappearing house again, still trying to figure out that mind-bending mystery. At a little past 8, the front doorbell rang. Kate went to see who it was. I could see her talking to someone, but I couldn't tell who. My hand went for my revolver, touched the handle. She let the visitor come inside. It was Kyle Craig. I was immediately struck by the drawn and somber look on his face. Something must have happened. "Kyle says he has something you're going to want to see," Kate said as she led the FBI man into the living room. "I tracked you down, Alex. It wasn't too hard," Kyle said. He sat on the sofa arm next to me. He looked as if he needed to sit down. "I told the hotel desk and the operator where I'd be until 9 or so. Like I said, it wasn't hard. Check out the look on Alex's face, Kate. Now you see why he's still a detective. He's hooked on the job, wants to solve all the great puzzles, even the not-so-great ones." I smiled and shook my head. Kyle was partly right. "I love my work, Mostly because I get to spend time with sophisticated and high-minded individuals like yourself. What's happened, Kyle? Tell me right now. The gentleman made a personal call on Beth Lieberman. She's dead. He cut off her fingers, Alex. After he killed her, he torched her studio apartment in West Los Angeles. He set half her building on fire. Beth Lieberman hadn't exactly endeared herself to me, but I was shocked and saddened to hear about her murder. I'd taken Kyle's word that she had nothing worth traveling to Los Angeles for. Maybe he knew there was something in her apartment that needed to be torched. Maybe she actually had something important. Kyle glanced over at Kate again. You see how good he is? He's a machine. She did have something incriminating, he said to both of us. Only she had it on her computer at the Times. So now we have it. Kyle handed me a long, curling fax. He pointed to some copy at the very bottom of the sheet. The fax was from the FBI's office in Los Angeles. I glanced down the page and read the entry that was underscored. Possible Casanova, it said. Very possible suspect. Dr. William Rudolph. First class creep. Home, the Beverly Comstock. Work, Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Los Angeles. We finally got our break. We've got our first class lead, anyway, Kyle said. The gentleman could be this doctor, this creep, as she calls him. Kate looked at me, then at Kyle. She had told both of us that Casanova might be a doctor. Anything else in Lieberman's notes? I asked Kyle. Not that we've been able to find so far, Kyle said. Unfortunately, we can't ask Ms. Lieberman about Dr. William Rudolph, or why she made the note in her computer. Let me tell you two new theories that are making the rounds with our profilers out on the West Coast. Kyle went on. Are you ready for a little outrageous mind trip, my friend? Some profiler speculation? I'm ready. Let's hear the latest and greatest theories from FBI West. The first theory is that he's sending the diary entries to himself. That he's Casanova and the gentleman caller. He could be both killers, Alex. They each specialize in perfect crimes. There are other similarities, too. Maybe he's a split personality. FBI West, as you call it, would like Dr. McTiernan to fly out to Los Angeles right away. They'd like to talk to her. I didn't like the first West Coast theory too much myself, but I couldn't completely discount it. What's the other theory from the Wild Wild West? I asked Kyle. The other theory, he said, is that there are two men. But they aren't just communicating. They're competing. This could be a scary competition, Alex. This could all be a scary game they've invented. Part 3. The Gentleman Caller. Chapter 60. He had been a southern gentleman, a gentleman scholar. Now he was the very finest gentleman in Los Angeles. Always a gentleman, though. A hearts and flowers kind of guy. An orangish-red sun had begun its long, slow shimmy and slide toward the Pacific Ocean. Dr. William Rudolph thought it looked visually stunning as he strolled at a leisurely pace along Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles. The gentleman caller was shopping that afternoon, absorbing all the sights and sounds, the hectic flash and cash of his surroundings. The street scene reminded him of something one of the hard-boiled detective writers, maybe Raymond Chandler, had written. California, the department store. The description still worked pretty damn well. Most of the attractive women he observed were in their early and mid-twenties. They had just come from the stultifying workaday world of the ad agencies, money managers, and law firms in the entertainment district around Century Boulevard. Several of them wore high heels, platforms, clinging spandex miniskirts, here and there a form-fitting Rolo suit. He listened to the casually sexy rustle of crushed silk, the martial click-click of designer shoes, the sultry scuff of cowboy boots that cost more than Wyatt Earp had earned in a lifetime. He was getting hot and a little frenzied, nicely frenzied. Life in California was good. It was the department store of his dreams. This was the best part, the foreplay before he made his final selection. The Los Angeles police were still stumped and baffled by him. Maybe one day they would figure it all out, but probably not. He was simply too good at this. He was Jekyll and Hyde for this age. As he strolled between La Brea and Fairfax, he breathed in the scents of musk and heavy floral perfumes, of chamomile and lemon-scented hair. The leather handbags and skirts also had a distinct scent. It was all a big tease, but he adored it. It was so ironic that these lovely California foxes were teasing and provoking him, of all people. He was the small, adorable, fluffy-haired boy loose in the candy store, wasn't he? Now, which forbidden sweets should he choose this afternoon? That little twit in red heels, no stockings? That poor man's Juliette Binoche? The provocateuse in the French vanilla and black harlequin print suit? Several of the women actually gave Dr. Will Randolph approving glances as they wandered in and out of their favorite shops. Exit 1, Leathers and Treasures, La Luz de Jesus. He was strikingly handsome, even by strict Hollywood standards. He resembled the singer Bono from the Irish rock group U2. Actually, he looked the way Bono would if he had chosen to become a successful doctor in Dublin or Cork, or right here in Los Angeles. And that was one of the gentleman's most private secrets. The women almost always chose him. Will Rudolph wandered into Nativity, which was one of the currently hot A-rated shops on Melrose. Nativity was the place to buy a designer bustier, a mink-lined leather jacket, an antique Hamilton wristwatch. As he watched the supple young bodies in the busy store, he was thinking of Hollywood's A-parties, its A-restaurants, even its A-stores. The city was completely hung up on its own pecking order. He understood status perfectly. Yes, he did. Dr. Will Rudolph was the most powerful man in Los Angeles. He reveled in the secure feeling it gave him, the reassuring front-page news stories that told him he truly existed, that he wasn't a twisted figment of his own imagination. The gentleman was in control of an entire city, and an influential city at that. He strolled near an irresistible blonde woman, all decked out in 20-something finery. She was idly looking at ink and jewelry, seemingly bored with the whole deal. Her life. She was by far the most striking woman inside Nativity, but that wasn't what attracted him to her. She was absolutely untouchable. She sent off a clear signal, even in a pricey store filled mostly with other attractive 20-something females. I'm untouchable. Don't even think about it. You're unworthy, no matter who you are. He felt thunder roar through his chest. He wanted to scream out inside the loud, crowded boutique, I can have you. I can. You have no idea, but I'm the gentleman caller. The blonde woman had a full and arrogant mouth. She understood that no lipstick or eyeshadow was necessary for her. She was slender and narrow-waisted, elegant in her own Southern California way. She wore a faded cotton vest, wrapped skirt, and color-blocked moccasins. Her tan was even and perfect, healthy-looking. She finally glanced his way. A glancing blow, Dr. Will Rudolph thought. Lord, what eyes! He wanted them all to himself. He wanted to roll them through his fingers, carry them around for a good luck charm. What she saw was a tall and slender, interesting-looking man in his early 30s. He had broad shoulders and a build like an athlete or even a dancer. His sun-lightened brown curls were tied back in a ponytail. He had Irish boy blue eyes. Will Rudolph also wore a slightly wrinkled white medical jacket over his very traditional Oxford blue shirt and hospital-approved striped reps tie. He had on expensive Dr. Martin's boots, indestructible footwear. He seemed so sure of himself. She spoke first. She chose him, didn't she? Her blue eyes were calm and deep, untroubled, very sexy in their confidence. She played with one of her gold-plated earrings.
Was it something I didn't say?
He started to laugh, genuinely delighted that she had an adult sense of humor about the dating charade. This was going to be a fun night, he thought. He knew it. I'm sorry. I usually don't stare. At least I never get caught blatantly doing it, he said. He couldn't stop laughing for a moment. He had an easy laugh, a pleasant laugh. It was a modern tool of the trade, especially in Hollywood, New York, Paris, his favorite haunts.
At least you're honest about it, she said.
She was laughing now, too, and a gold-linked necklace jangled against her chest. He ached to reach out and rip it off, to run his tongue over her breasts. She was doomed now, if that was his desire, his wish, his slightest whim. Should he go on? Perhaps look a little further? The blood in his head was roaring, swirling with tremendous force. He had to decide. He looked into the untroubled blue eyes of the blonde woman again and saw the answer.
I don't know about you, he said, trying to sound calm, but I think I found what I like very much in here. Yes, I think I may have found what I need, too, she said after a pause.
Then she laughed.
Where are you from? You're not from around here, are you?
Originally from North Carolina.
He held the bell-jangling door open for her, and they left the antique clothing store together.
I've worked on losing my accent. You've succeeded, she said.
She was wonderfully impressed with herself, not the least bit self-conscious. She had an aura of self-confidence and competency, which he would absolutely shatter. Oh, God, he wanted this one so badly. Chapter 61
Here we go, action fans. He's leaving Nativity with the blonde girl. They're out on Melrose Avenue.
We were using binoculars to watch the incredible encounter through Nativity's decorative front window. The FBI also had directional microphones on Dr. Will Rudolph, as well as on the blonde woman in the trendy shop. It was an FBI-only stakeout. They hadn't even clued in the LAPD. Nada. It was pretty typical bureau tactics. Only I was on their side this time, compliments of Kyle Craig. The FBI had wanted to talk to Kate in Los Angeles. Kyle arranged for me to come, after I beat on him, about the deal we'd made, and how this could be the most important break we'd had on the Casanova investigation. It was just past 5:30, noisy, chaotic rush hour on a California gorgeous sunny day, temperature in the mid-70s, heartbeats rising toward at least 1,000 inside our car. We were finally closing in on one of the monsters, at least we hope so. Dr. Will Rudolph struck me as a modern-day vampire. He had spent the afternoon casually roaming among the stylish shops, Ecru, Grau, Mark Fox. Even the girls idling in front of Johnny Rocket's 50s-style burger stand were potential targets of his. He was definitely a hunter today. He was girl-watching. Was he the gentleman caller, though? I was working closely with two senior FBI agents in an anonymous-looking minivan parked on a side street off Melrose Avenue. Our radio was hooked to the state-of-the-art directional mics that were in two of the other five cars trailing the man believed to be the gentleman. It was almost showtime.
I think I may have found what I need, too, we heard the blonde woman say.
She reminded me of the beautiful students Casanova had abducted in the South. Could he be one and the same monster, a coast-to-coast killer? Maybe a split personality.
FBI experts here on the West Coast believed they had the answer. In their view, the same creep did the so-called perfect crimes on both coasts. A victim had never been kidnapped or killed on the same day. Unfortunately, there were at least a dozen theories about the gentleman caller in Casanova that I was aware of. I still wasn't convinced by any of them.
How long have you been in Hollywood?
We heard the blonde woman ask Rudolph. Her voice sounded alluring and sexy. She was obviously flirting with him.
Long enough to meet you. He was soft-spoken and courteous so far. His right hand rested lightly under her left elbow.
The gentleman?
He didn't look like a killer, but he did resemble the Casanova that Kate McTiernan had described. He was a hunk physically, clearly attractive to women, and he was a doctor. His eyes were blue, the color Kate had seen behind Casanova's mask.
"Cockfucker looks like he could have any girl he wanted," one of the FBI agents turned to me and said.
"Not to do what he wants to do to them," I said.
"You got a point there."
The agent, John Acero, was Mexican-American. He was balding, but with a compensating bushy mustache. He was probably in his late 40s. The other agent was Raymond Cosgrove. Both of them were good men, high-level bureau professionals. Al Craig was taking care of me so far. I couldn't take my eyes off Rudolph and the blonde woman. She was pointing toward a shiny black Mercedes convertible with its tan top down. More expensive shops stood out in the background. IAI Works, Galley Melrose. Another garish store sign, 8-foot-high cowboy boots, framed her wind-blown hair. We listened as they talked on the crowded street. The directional mics picked up everything. No one in the surveillance car was making a sound.
"That's my car over there, sport. The red-haired lady in the passenger seat? She's my sweetie.
Did you really think you could pick me up just like that?" The blonde woman snapped her fingers, and the colorful bracelets on her arm rattled in Rudolph's face.
"Kiss off, Dr. Kildare."
John Asaro groaned out loud.
"Christ, she shot him down. She set him up. Isn't that beautiful? Only in L.A.'
Raymond Cosgrove pounded the dash with the thick heel of his hand.
"Son of a bitch! She's walking away. Go back to him, sweetheart. Tell him you were only kidding."
We'd had him, or were very close to it. It made me physically sick to think that he was getting away. We had to catch him at something, or an arrest wouldn't hold up. The blonde woman crossed Melrose and slid into the sleek black Mercedes. Her friend had short red hair, and her silver bangle earrings caught the late-day sunlight. The woman leaned in and gave her sweetie a kiss. As Dr. Will Rudolph watched them, he didn't appear at all upset. He stood on the sidewalk with his hands stuffed into the pockets of his white jacket, looking cool and relaxed, neutral, as if nothing had happened. Were we seeing the gentleman caller's mask? The two lovers in the convertible waved as the Mercedes roared past, and he gave them a smile, a shrug of the shoulders, a cool nod of his head. We could hear him hiss through the directional mics.
"Ciao, ladies. I'd like to cut you both into pieces and feed you to the gulls at Venice Beach. And I do have your license plate number, you silly twats."
Chapter 62. We trailed Dr. Will Rudolph to his luxury penthouse apartment at the Beverly Comstock. The FBI knew where he lived. They hadn't shared that information with the LAPD either. The tension and disappointment were heavy inside our car. The FBI was playing a dangerous game of freeze-out with the Los Angeles police. I finally left the stakeout at around 11 o'clock. Rudolph had been inside for more than 4 hours. A loud, unidentifiable buzzing noise in my head wouldn't go away. I was still moving on Eastern time. It was 2 a.m. for me, and I needed to get some sleep soon. The FBI agents promised to call right away if anything broke, or if Dr. Rudolph went out hunting again that night. It had to have been a bad scene for him on Melrose, and I thought that he might go after someone else soon. If he was actually the gentleman caller. I was driven to the Holiday Inn at sunset in Sepulveda. Kate McTiernan was staying there, too. The FBI had flown her to California because Kate knew more about Casanova than anyone they had assigned to the case. She had been kidnapped by the creep and had lived to tell about it. Kate might be able to identify the killer if he and Casanova were the same person. She had spent most of the day being interviewed at the FBI offices in downtown Los Angeles. Her room was several doors down from mine at the hotel. I only had to knock once before she opened a white door with a black 26 on the knocker.
"I couldn't sleep. I was up waiting," she said.
"What happened? Tell me everything."
I guess I wasn't in a great mood after the failed bust. "Unfortunately, nothing happened," I told her the bottom line. Kate nodded, waiting for more. She had on a light blue tank top, khaki shorts, and yellow flip-flops. She was wide awake and revved up. I was glad to see her, even at 2:30 on a shitty morning. I finally came in and we talked about the FBI stakeout on Melrose Avenue. I told Kate how close we might have come to getting Dr. Will Rudolph. I remembered everything he'd said, every gesture. He sounded like a gentleman. He acted like a gentleman, too, right up until the blonde woman made him angry.
"What does he look like?"
Kate asked. She was eager to help. I couldn't blame her. The FBI had flown her to Los Angeles, then stuck her in a hotel room for most of the day and night.
I know how you feel, Kate. I've talked to the FBI, and you're going to ride with me tomorrow. You're going to see him, probably in the morning. I don't want to set up any bias in your mind. Is that okay? Kate nodded, but I could tell her feelings were hurt. She definitely wasn't happy about her level of involvement so far. I'm sorry. I don't want to act like a tough detective, a controlling bastard, I finally said. Let's not fight about it.
Well, you were distant. Anyway, you're forgiven. I guess we better get some sleep. Tomorrow's another day. Big day, maybe.
Yeah, tomorrow could be a big day. I really am sorry, Kate.
I know you are,
she finally smiled.
You really are forgiven. Sweet dreams.
Tomorrow we nail Beavis, then we get Butthead. I finally went off to my room. I hit the bed and thought about Kyle Craig for a while. He'd been able to sell my unorthodox style to his confreres for one reason. It had worked before. I already had one monster's scalp on my belt. I hadn't played according to the rules to get it. Kyle understood and respected results. In general, so did the Bureau. They were certainly playing according to their own rules here in Los Angeles. My last semi-conscious thought was of Kate in those khaki shorts. Take your breath away. I had a passing thought that she might come down the hall and knock, knock, knock on my door. We were in Hollywood, after all. Wasn't that the way it happened in the movies? But Kate didn't come knocking on my hotel door. So much for Clint Eastwood and Rene Russo fantasies. Chapter 63. This was going to be a big day in Tinseltown. The manhunt of manhunts was playing in Beverly Hills, just like the day they finally caught the killer strangler Richard Ramirez out here. Today we get Beavis. It was a few minutes past 8 in the morning. Kate and I were sitting in an Arctic blue Taurus, parked half a block from Cedars Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. There was an electric sound in the air, as if the city were being run on a single huge generator. A play on an old line ran through my head. Hell is a city much like Los Angeles. I was nervous and tense. My body felt numb and my stomach was queasy. The burnout factor. Not enough sleep. Too much stress for too long a stretch. Chasing monsters from sea to shining sea. That's Dr. Will Rudolph climbing out of the BMW, I said to Kate. I was so wound up. I felt as if strong hands were squeezing me.
Good looking, Kate muttered. Real sure of himself, too, the way he moves. Dr. Rudolph.
Kate didn't say another word as she intently watched Rudolph. Was he the gentleman caller? Was he also Casanova? Or were we being set up for some sick psychopathic reason that I didn't understand yet? The morning's temperature hovered in the low 60s. The air had a crisp snap like fall in the northeast. Kate had on an old college sweatsuit, high-topped running shoes, dime-store sunglasses. Her long brown hair was bunched back in a ponytail. Sensible stakeout attire and grooming.
Alex, the FBI is all around him now?
She asked me without looking away from the binoculars.
They're here right now. That scum can't possibly get away.
I nodded. If he does anything, anything that shows us he's a gentleman, they'll grab him. They want this arrest for themselves. But the FBI was also giving me whatever rope I needed. Kyle Craig had kept his promise, so far anyway. Kate and I watched as Dr. Will Rudolph slid out of the BMW coupe, which he'd just parked in a private lot on the west side of the hospital. He wore a European-style charcoal gray suit. It was cut well and looked expensive. It probably cost as much as my house in D.C., His brown hair was held back in a fashionable ponytail. He had on dark glasses with round tortoiseshell frames. A doctor in an exclusive Beverly Hills hospital, smug as hell. The goddamn gentleman caller who was setting the city on fire? I ached to run across the parking lot and hit him, take him down right now. I ground my teeth until my jaw was stiff. Kate wouldn't take her eyes away from Dr. Will Rudolph. Was he Casanova, too? Were they one and the same monster? Was that it? We both watched Rudolph as he crossed the hospital lot. His stride was long and quick and buoyant. Nothing bothering him today. Finally, he disappeared inside a gray metal side door of the hospital.
"A doctor,"
Kate said, and shook her head back and forth.
"This is so weird, Alex. I'm shaking on the inside."
The static on the car radio startled us, but we could hear Agent John Asaro's deep, raspy voice.
"Alex, did you guys see him? Get a good look? What does Ms. McTiernan think? What's the verdict on our Dr. Squirrel?"
I looked across the front seat at Kate. She looked all of her 31 years right now. Not quite so confident and assured, a little gray around the gills. The prime witness. She understood the deadly seriousness of the moment perfectly.
"I don't think he's Casanova," Kate finally said.
She shook her head.
"He's not the same physical type. He's thinner. Carries himself differently. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think it's him, God damn it."
She sounded a little disappointed. Kate continued to shake her head.
"I'm almost sure he isn't Casanova, Alex. There must be two of them. Two Mr. Squirrels."
Her brown eyes were intense as she looked at me.
So there were two of them. Were they competing? What the hell was their coast-to-coast game all about?
Chapter 64. Small talk, surveillance talk, it was familiar territory for me. Samson and I had a saying about surveillance back in D.C. They do the crime, we do the time. How much could he make with a successful Beverly Hills medical practice? Ballpark number, Kate, I asked my partner. We were still watching the doctor's private parking lot of Cedars-Sinai. There was nothing to do but eyeball Rudolph's spiffy new BMW and wait, and talk like old friends on a front stoop in D.C.
He probably charges about $150 to $200 a visit. He could gross $500,000 or $600,000 a year. Then there are surgery fees, Alex. That's if he has a conscience about the prices he charges, and we know he doesn't have a conscience.
I shook my head in disbelief as I rubbed my palm over my chin. I have to get back into private practice. Baby needs new shoes. Kate smiled.
You miss them, don't you, Alex? You talk about your kids a lot, Damon and Janny, Poolhead and Velcro.
I smiled back. Kate knew my nicknames for the kids by now.
Yeah, I do. They're my babies, my little pals.
Kate laughed some more. I liked to make her laugh. I thought of the bittersweet story she'd told me about her sisters, especially her twin, Kristen. Laughter is good medicine. The black BMW coupe just sat there, shining brightly and expensively in the California sunlight. Surveillance sucks, I thought. No matter where you have to do it, even in sunny L.A. Kyle Craig had gotten me a lot of rope here in Los Angeles, certainly much more than I'd had in the South. He'd gotten rope for Kate, too. There was something in it for him, though. The old quid pro quo. Kyle wanted me to interview the gentleman caller once he was caught, and he expected me to report everything to him. I suspected that Kyle himself hoped to bag Casanova.
"Do you really think the two of them are competing?" Kate asked me after a while.
"It makes psychological sense out of some things for me," I told her. "They might feel a need to one-up each other. The gentleman's diaries could be his way of saying, 'See, I'm better than you. I'm more famous.' Anyway, I haven't decided yet. Sharing their exploits is probably more for thrill purposes than intimacy, though. They both like to get turned on." Kate stared into my eyes.
"Alex, doesn't it make you feel creepy as hell trying to figure this out?"
I smiled. "That's why I want to catch Butthead and Beavis, so the creepiness will finally stop." Kate and I waited at the hospital until Rudolph finally reappeared. It was nearly 2 p.m. He drove straight to his office on North Bedford, west of Rodeo Drive. Rudolph saw patients there, mostly women patients. Dr. Rudolph was a plastic surgeon. As such, he could create and sculpt. Women depended on him, and his patients all chose him. We followed Rudolph home at around 7. 500,000 or 600,000 a year, I was thinking. It was more than I could make in a decade. Was it the money he needed to be the gentleman caller? Was Casanova wealthy, too? Was he a doctor, also? Was that how they committed their perfect crimes? These questions were rolling around in my head. I fingered an index card in my trouser pocket. I had begun to keep a short list on both Casanova and the gentleman. I would add or subtract what I considered key attributes to the profile. I carried the card with me at all times. Casanova, collector, harem, artist, organized. Different masks, to represent moods or personas. Doctor, claims to love victims, gaining a taste for violence, knows about me. Competing with Gary Sonogy? Competing with the L.A. gentleman? Gentleman. Gives out flowers. Sexual? Extremely violent and dangerous. Takes beautiful young women of all types. Extremely organized. Not artistic in terms of his killing. Doctor. Cold and impersonal as a killer. A butcher. Craves recognition and fame. Possibly wealthy. Penthouse apartment. Graduated Duke Medical School 1986. Raised in North Carolina. I thought some more about the connection between Rudolph and Casanova as Kate and I twiddled our thumbs outside the apartment. A relevant psychological condition had occurred to me. It was called twinning, and it could be a key. Twinning just might explain the bizarre relationship between the monsters. Twinning was caused by an urge to bond, usually between two lonely people. Once they twin, the two become a whole. They become dependent on each other, often obsessively so. Sometimes the twins become highly competitive. Twinning was like an addiction to couple, to belong to a secret club. Just two people and no passwords. In its negative form, it was the fusing of two people for their own individual needs, which weren't mutually healthy. I ran it by Kate. She was a twin, too. Quite often there's a dominant figure in a twinning relationship, I said. Was that true of you and your sister?
I probably was with Kristen, Kate said. I got the good grades in school. I was a little pushy sometimes. She even called me Push in high school. Worse names than that, too.
The dominant twin can act in a male role model behavior structure, I said to Kate. The two of us were talking doctor to doctor. The dominant figure might not be the more skillful at manipulation, though.
As you can imagine, I've read a little about the phenomenon, Kate said, and smiled. Twinning creates a uniquely powerful structure within which the bonded pair can operate in complex ways. Something like that?
That's correct, Dr. McTiernan. In the case of Casanova and the gentleman, each would have his own bodyguard cum supportive person. That could be why they achieve so well. Perfect crimes. They each have a built-in and very effective emotional support system. The question ringing loudly in my mind was, how had they originally met? Was it at Duke? Had Casanova been a student there, too? It made some sense. It also reminded me of the Leopold Loeb case in Chicago. Two very smart boys, special boys, committing forbidden acts together. Sharing evil thoughts and dirty secrets because they were lonely and had no one else to talk to. Twinning at its most destructive. Was that the beginning of the solution to this puzzle, I wondered? Were the gentleman and Casanova twinning? Were they actually working together? What was their nasty little game all about? What game were they playing?
"Let's go smash in his picture windows with a tire iron," Kate said.
She was feeling it, too. We were both ready to rumble. We wanted to take down this grown-up Leopold and Loeb. Chapter 65 8 o'clock came and went on the surveillance watch. Maybe Dr. Will Randolph wasn't the gentleman caller. The Los Angeles Times reporter Beth Lieberman could have been wrong. There was no way to ask her about it now. Kate and I had been gabbing about the Lakers without Magic Johnson and Kareem, about Aaron Neville's latest album, Hillary and Bill Clinton's life together, the merits of Johns Hopkins versus University of North Carolina Medical School. Strange sparks were still flying between us. I'd had some unofficial therapy sessions with Kate McTiernan, and I had hypnotized her once.
I also understood that I was afraid of any kind of fire starting between us. What was wrong with me? It was time to start my life again, to get over the loss of my wife Maria. I thought I had something good with a woman named Jessie Flanagan, but she had left an emptiness in me that I could barely get over. Kate and I finally began to cover subjects a little closer to the heart. She asked why I was shying away from relationships. Because my wife had died, because my last relationship had imploded, because of my two kids. I asked her why she was wary of meaningful relationships. She was afraid she was going to die of ovarian or breast cancer like her sisters. She was afraid her lovers might die or leave her, that she would keep on losing people. "We're quite a pair," I finally shook my head and smiled. "Maybe we're both terrified of losing someone again," Kate said. "Maybe it's better to love and lose than be afraid." Before we could really get into that thorny subject, Dr. Will Rudolph finally reappeared. I looked at the time on the dashboard clock. It was 10:20. Rudolph was decked out in all black party clothes, form-fitting blazer, turtleneck, clinging slacks, snazzy cowboy boots. He got into a white Range Rover this time, instead of the BMW sedan. He looked freshly showered. Probably had taken a nap. I envied him that. "Black on black for the good doctor," Kate said with a tight smile. "Dressed to kill." "Maybe he has a dinner date," I said. "Now there's a scary idea. He sups with the women, then kills them." "That could get him inside their apartments, at least. What a terrible creep. Two unbelievable creeps on the loose." I started up our car and we followed Rudolph. I didn't see any FBI coverage, but I was sure they were there. The Bureau still hadn't brought in the LAPD on this. It was a dangerous game, but not an unusual one for the FBI. They considered themselves the best policeman for any job, and the ultimate authority. They had decided this was an interstate crime spree, so it was theirs to solve. Somebody at the Bureau had a hard-on for this case. "Vampires always hunt at night, huh?" Kate said as we headed south through L.A. "That's what this feels like, Alex. Bram Stoker is the gentleman caller. A real-life horror story." I knew what Kate was feeling. I felt it, too. "He is a monster, only he's created himself. So is Casanova. It's another similarity they share. Bram Stoker, Mary Shelley. They wrote only about human monsters roaming the earth. Now we have sickos living out their elaborate fantasies. What a country." "Love it or leave it, bub," Kate said with a drawl and a wink. I had done enough surveillance early in my career to get reasonably good at it. I figured I'd earned a graduate degree in tracking during the Sonogy Murphy manhunt. So far, I'd noticed that the West Coast FBI was good, too. Agents Asaro and Cosgrove checked in on the radio as soon as we started to move again. They were in charge of the tracking unit on Will Rudolph. We still didn't know if he was the gentleman. We had no proof. We couldn't move on Dr. Rudolph yet. We followed the Range Rover west through Los Angeles. Rudolph finally turned onto Sunset Drive and took it all the way to the Pacific Coast Highway. Then he headed north on U.S. Highway 1. I noticed that he was careful to keep the Range Rover at the speed limit inside L.A. But once he hit the open road, he started to fly. "Where the heck is he going?" "My heart's in my throat," Kate finally admitted. "We'll be okay." "It seems scary chasing him at night," I said. It did feel as if we were alone with him. Where the hell was he going? Was he hunting? If his pattern held, he was due for another killing soon. He had to be in heat. It turned out to be a very long ride. We watched the stars brighten the coastal California night. 6 hours later, we were still tacking on Highway 1. The Range Rover finally pulled off at a quaint wooden signpost that read Big Sur State Park, among other things. As if to validate that we were really in Big Sur, we passed an antique van with a bumper sticker, "Visualize Industrial Collapse." "Visualize Dr. Will Rudolph having a massive stroke," Kate growled softly. I checked my watch as we left the main highway. "It's past 3, getting late for him to get into any serious trouble tonight." I hoped that was the case.
If there was ever any doubt, this may prove he's a blood-sucking vampire, Kate muttered. Her arms were crossed tightly across her chest and had been for most of the long ride.
He's going off to sleep in his favorite coffin.
Right. That's when we drive a wooden stake through his heart, I told her. We were both a little groggy. I had taken a pill during the ride. Kate declined. She said she knew too much about drugs and was leery of most of them. We passed a complex of directional signs. Point Sur, Pfeiffer Beach, Big Sur Lodge, Ventana, the Esalen Institute. Will Rudolph headed in the direction of Big Sur Lodge, Sycamore Canyon, Botcher's Gap Campgrounds.
I was hoping he would go to Esalen, Kate quipped. Learn to meditate, deal with his inner turmoil.
What in hell is he up to tonight? I wondered out loud. What were he and Casanova doing? So far it was impossible to figure out. His hideaway might be up here in the woods, Kate, I offered a thought. Maybe he has a house of horror just like Casanova's.
Twinning, I thought again. It made a lot of sense. They would be providing support systems for each other. Parallel tracks for the two monsters.
Where did they meet, though? Did the two of them ever hunt together? I suspected that they had. The white Range Rover was winding along a hilly and rather rambunctious side road that branched east from the ocean. Ancient, somber redwoods flashed on either side of the narrow ribbon of highway. A pale full moon seemed to be moving directly above the rover, following it. I let him get a safe distance ahead, so that he was actually out of our sight. The huge fir trees seemed to float past our car on either road shoulder, dark shadows in real life. A bright yellow sign in the headlights read, "Impassable in wet weather."
"He's right there, Alex." Kate's warning came a little too late. "He stopped."
The gentleman's hooded eyes glared at our car as we passed him and the Range Rover. He had seen us. Chapter 66. Dr. Will Rudolph had turned into a rutted dirt and gravel driveway hidden from the main road. He was stopped down inside the rover and was gathering an armful of who knew what from the back seat. He stared up at our passing car with a cold, questioning look in his eyes. I kept speeding along on the blacktop road that was accentuated by overhanging gnarled black branches. A few hundred yards farther, just around a curve, I eased over onto the narrow shoulder. I stopped in front of a dented metal road sign that promised more dangerous twists and turns in the road up ahead. "He's stopped at a cabin," I said into the FBI car's two-way radio. "He's on foot, out of the rover."
"We saw that. We've got him, Alex," Jonasaro's voice came back over the two-way radio. "We're on the other side of the cabin now. Looks dark inside. He's turning on lights." "El País Grande del Sur. That's what the Spanish called this place way back when. Beautiful spot to catch this fucker."
Kate and I got out of the car. She looked a little pale, understandably so. The temperature was probably in the 40s, maybe even the 30s, and the mountain air was bracing, but Kate wasn't shivering just from the damp cold. "We're going to get him soon," I said to her. "He's starting to make mistakes."
"It could be another house of horror. You were right," she said in a low voice.
Her eyes stared straight ahead. I hadn't seen her this unsettled since I'd first met her in the hospital.
"It feels like it, Alex. Feels almost the same. Feels creepy. I'm not being very brave, am I?"
"Believe me, Kate, I'm not feeling particularly brave right now either." The thick coastal fog seemed to roll on forever. My stomach felt icy and sour. We had to get moving. Kate and I went into the dark screen of woods, heading toward the cabin. The north wind whistled and howled loudly through the towering redwood and fir trees. I had no idea what to expect from here on.
"Shit," Kate whispered her summation of the night's experience. "I'm not kidding, Alex."
"You've got that right. El País Grande del Sur at 3 o'clock in the morning." Rudolph had come to a lonely outpost on the edge of the earth. Casanova had a house in the south in the deep woods, too. A disappearing house where he kept a collection of young women. I thought of the spooky diaries in the Los Angeles Times.
Could Naomi have been moved out here for some crazy psychopathic reason? Maybe she was being kept in the cabin or somewhere nearby. I stopped walking suddenly. I could hear wind chimes, which sounded particularly creepy under the circumstances. Up ahead, a small cabin was visible. It was pink with white doors and white window trim. It looked like a pleasant enough summer place.
"He left a light for us," Kate whispered behind me. "I remember that Casanova used to play loud rock and roll music when he was in the house."
I could tell it was painful for her to be thinking about her captivity again, to be reliving it. "You see any similarities to this cabin?" I asked her. I was trying to be very still inside, trying to get ready for the gentleman.
"No. I only saw the inside of the other place, Alex. Let's hope it won't disappear on us."
"I'm hoping for a lot of things right now. I'll put that on the list." The cabin was an A-frame, and probably built to be a vacation home or weekend retreat. There were three or four bedrooms from the look of it. I took out my Glock as we got closer. The Glock was the weapon of choice these days in the inner city. It weighed a little over a pound when loaded and was easily concealed. It would probably work fine in El País Grande del Sur, too. Kate kept behind me as we moved toward a clearing in the trees that served as a backyard. There were actually two lights glittering and drawing bugs to the house. One was the front porch lamp, the second was in the back of the cabin. I made my way toward the second dimmer light in back. I gestured for Kate to stay back, which she did. "This could be the gentleman caller," I warned myself. "Take it very slow. This could also be a trap. Anything could happen here. There's no predicting from here on." I could see into a rear bedroom window. I was less than 10 steps away from the cabin walls, and probably the mass murderer who was terrifying the West Coast. Then I saw him. Dr. Will Rudolph was pacing around the small wood-paneled room, and he was talking to himself. He appeared to be highly agitated. He was hugging himself with both arms. As I moved closer, I could see that he was perspiring heavily. Not in good shape at all. The scene reminded me of quiet rooms in mental hospitals where patients sometimes go to act out their problems and volatile emotions. Rudolph suddenly screamed at someone, but there was no one else in the room. His face and his neck were bright crimson red as he screamed again and again, at absolutely no one. He was screaming at the top of his lungs. His veins looked ready to burst. Seeing him like this chilled me, and I slowly backed away from the cabin. I could still hear his voice, hear the words ringing in my ears. "God damn you, Casanova! Kiss the girls! Kiss the fucking girls yourself from now on!" Chapter 67. "What the hell is Cross doing?" Agent John Asaro asked his partner. They were in the thick woods on the other side of the cabin at Big Sur. The cabin reminded Asaro of the band's first album, music from Big Pink. He half expected Flower Children and hippies to step out of the fog.
"Maybe Cross is a peeping Tom, Johnny. What do I know? He's a guru, a squirrel profiler. He's Kyle Craig's boy," Ray Cosgrove said with a shrug. "So that means he can do whatever he wants to do?"
"Probably." Cosgrove shrugged a second time. He had seen far too many crazy situations, too many special accommodations in his bureau career, to let this one bother him.
"First of all," Cosgrove said, "whether we like it or not, he has Washington's blessing."
"I hate Washington with a freaking passion that just won't quit," Asaro said.
"Everybody hates Washington, Johnny.
Second, Cross strikes me as a pro, at least. He's not just some glory hound."
"Third," the older, more experienced partner continued, "and most important, what we have on Dr. Rudolph is hardly conclusive evidence that he's our squirrel. Otherwise, we would have called in the LAPD, Army, Navy, and Marines. Maybe the late Ms. Lieberman made a mistake when she logged his name into her computer. She definitely made some kind of mistake somewhere, Johnny. Maybe her hunch was all wrong. Maybe Will Rudolph was an ex-boyfriend of hers. She was just doodling his name on her PC.
Doubtful, but a possibility," Cosgrove said.
"So we watched Dr. Rudolph, and we watched Dr. Cross watch Dr. Rudolph," Agent Asaro said.
You got it, partner. Maybe Dr. Cross and Dr. McTiernan will provide us with a little entertainment, at least. Hey, you never know about these things, Raymond Cosgrove said. He was smiling now. He thought this whole thing was probably a wild goose chase, but it wouldn't be his first one. This was a huge, nasty case, no matter what. It was interstate now, and every possible lead was being chased down with a vengeance. A coast-to-coast serial squirrel connection. So he and his partner and two other FBI agents were going to hang around in the dark woods of Big Sur all night and into the morning, if need be. They would dutifully watch the summer cabin of a plastic surgeon from L.A., who maybe was a real bad killer, but maybe was just a plastic surgeon from L.A. They would watch Alex Cross and Dr. McTiernan and speculate about the two of them. Cosgrove wasn't really in the mood for any of this. On the other hand, it was a big case, and if he did happen to catch the gentleman caller, he might just become a glory hound himself. He wanted Al Pacino to play him in the movie. Pacino did Spanish guys, right? Chapter 68. Kate and I moved back a safe distance from the cabin. We ducked behind a stand of thick fir trees.
I heard him scream, Kate said, when we got into the deeper woods.
What did you see back there, Alex?
I saw the devil, I told her the truth. I saw an absolutely crazy and evil man talking to himself. If he isn't the gentleman, he does a great imitation.
The two of us took shifts, watching Rudolph's hideaway over the next several hours. That way, we both got some rest. Around 6 in the morning, I met with the FBI team, and they gave me a pocket-sized walkie-talkie in case we needed to talk in a hurry. I still wondered how much they'd told me about what they knew. When Dr. Will Rudolph eventually made another appearance outside, it was past 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. The silver-blue nimbus of sea mist had finally burned off. Scrub jays swooped and hollered overhead. Under different circumstances, it would have been a nice setting for a weekend in the mountains. Dr. Rudolph cleaned up in a whitewashed outdoor shower behind the house. He was muscular, with a washboard stomach, and looked agile and fit. He was extremely handsome. He cavorted and danced around in the nude. His bearing seemed a little formal. The gentleman.
He's so unbelievably sure of himself, Alex, Kate said as we watched Rudolph from the woods. Just look at him.
Everything seemed very odd and ritualistic. Was the dance part of his act, his pattern? When he finished his shower, he walked across the backyard to a small wildflower garden. He picked about a dozen flowers and brought them into the house.
The gentleman had his flowers. What now?
At 4 in the afternoon, Rudolph came out the back screen door of the cabin again. He was dressed in tight black jeans, a plain white pocket tee, black leather sandals. He hopped in the Range Rover and drove toward Highway 1. About 2 miles south on the coast road, he pulled into a restaurant and cafe called Nepenthe. Kate and I waited on the sandy road shoulder. Then we followed the Range Rover into a large, crowded parking lot. Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland was playing loudly from speakers hidden in the trees.
Maybe he's just your average, horny Los Angeles doctor, Kate said as we finally entered the parking area and searched for a space.
No, he's the gentleman, all right. He's our California butcher boy. I was sure of it after watching him the night before and now today.
Nepenthe was busy, filled mostly with good-looking people in their 20s and 30s, but also a sprinkling of aging hippies, some of whom were 60 or more. Stonewashed jeans, the latest West Coast swimsuit creations, colorful flip-flops, expensive hiking boots were everywhere. So were a lot of attractive women, I noticed. All ages, all sizes, all ethnic castes. Kiss the girls. I had heard of Nepenthe, actually. It had been hot and famous in the 60s, but even before that, Orson Welles had bought the desirable, breathtaking, beautiful property for Rita Hayworth. Kate and I watched how Dr. Rudolph operated at the bar. He was polite. A smile for the bartender, shared laughter. He looked around and seriously checked out several attractive women. Apparently they weren't attractive enough, though. He ventured out onto a large fieldstone terrace overlooking the Pacific. Rock music from the 70s and 80s was playing from an expensive sound system. The Grateful Dead, The Doors, The Eagles.
This was Hotel California. It's a beautiful spot for it, Alex. Whatever in hell he's up to.